From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. More promising news on the vaccine front today. Johnson & Johnson says that its COVID vaccine is 66% effective at preventing moderate to severe cases of the disease. At a White House COVID task force briefing earlier today, Dr. Anthony Fauci said the results are encouraging.
There were essentially no hospitalizations or deaths in the vaccine group, whereas in the placebo group, there were. So this really tells us that we have now a value-added additional vaccine candidate that will, of course, as happens with every candidate, will present the details of their data to the FDA.
Joining us now is Dr. Dan Baruch, director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He and his team have been collaborating with Johnson & Johnson on this vaccine. Dr. Baruch, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
This appears to be a pretty key step to getting a third vaccine to the American public. What should we take away from this data?
The results announced today by Johnson & Johnson report that this vaccine offers substantial protection against symptomatic COVID disease and outstanding protection against severe disease as well as hospitalizations and death.
And so I want to be clear, if you get sick after having taken this vaccine, there is a decent chance that it will not be bad enough to send you to the hospital or even kill you. Is that correct?
That's correct. So what we know is that for people who receive this vaccine, even those who did get infected had a much more mild course of infection. So this vaccine showed 85% protection against severe COVID disease and 100% protection against hospitalizations and mortality.
So what would you say to people who are hearing these numbers and say, well, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine are closer to 90% effective, but the Johnson & Johnson top line number is 66%? For people who might be concerned about that, what would you tell them?
The J&J vaccine was tested in multiple countries simultaneously, as well as in a pandemic that is a much more complicated pandemic now than it was several months ago, including some regions of the world, such as the United States, that have some circulating resistant variants, and other regions of the world, like South Africa, that have predominantly resistant variants. So the ability to protect in the context of today's pandemic is a very important result.
Well, and it was just a coincidence that Johnson & Johnson happened to test this vaccine in South Africa, where that new, more dangerous strain has emerged. What more do we know about the effect that this injection would have against that variant?
There is a different protection rate seen in different countries. It was 72% effective in the United States, and it had a lower protection rate in South Africa. The choice of the locations for the vaccine trials, including in Brazil and South Africa, was made before we knew that viral variants were emerging rapidly in those geographic areas. And so it is very fortunate that now we can see protective efficacy of this vaccine in the very regions of the world where we are seeing the emergence of these concerning viral variants.
Would a new formula directed at the South African strain require a whole new set of trials?
So J&J, as well as many of the other vaccine developers, are very interested in the possibility of updating or revising their vaccines, or maybe developing a boost formulation that includes the specific sequence of the South Africa variant that appears to escape partially from antibodies and may reduce vaccine efficacy. And so time will tell whether revisions or booster doses that include the actual South Africa sequence will be needed and relevant, and if so, how quickly they can be implemented.
Another big difference here is that this vaccine only requires one shot as opposed to two. It also does not need the extra cold storage of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Why is that important?
We know from a mass vaccination campaign that simplicity leads to efficiency. So the simpler the vaccine administration can be, the more successful a vaccine rollout will be, both in the United States and in particular in the developing world.
All right. So as far as the timing of that rollout goes, what's next? We know it has to go to the Food and Drug Administration for authorization, but how soon could this be widely available in the United States?
So Johnson & Johnson is planning to apply to the FDA for emergency use authorization in the coming days. And if the FDA approves this vaccine under emergency use authorization, then it potentially could become available towards the end of February of this year.
Dr. Dan Baruch, Director of the Center for Virology and Vaccine Research at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Dr. Baruch, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, the internet is still buzzing over the unusual surge in the share price of the video game retailer GameStop. This was all driven by amateur investors on a popular Reddit message board. And let's talk about all of this and more with Femi Oke, our social media expert and host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Happy Friday, Femi.
Thank you, Tanya. Hello, how are you?
I am well. So I mentioned a lot of the action is actually happening on Wall Street Bets Reddit. You're watching all of this in real time.
Oh, my goodness. It was like being on a roller coaster. So midweek, Rome says, okay, what gives? What has GameStop done that warrants this suddenly? Three new board members? What else? He is stunned. He's looking at the GameStop share price, stock price go up and up and up. Threnda Groen posts. Now, Threnda is a historian. I like the short, snappy way he gets Rome up to speed. Redditors buying the stock up just to stick it to the short sellers. And more citizen investors then piled in as they saw all of this action happening out on social and piled into the Robinhood app. And the Robinhood app then decide to shut it all down.
Right.
Tanya.
Right. And lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ted Cruz have criticized Robinhood for restricting customers' ability to buy stock on GameStop. What's the response been to that online?
So I looked to see what the Twitter profile description was for Robinhood app, and they say, democratizing finance for all. How ironic after this week. So their founder, their co-founder posts, we cannot control the lightning fast spread of information and misinformation that takes place on social media. And for that, I am incredibly sorry to our customers and staff for this. Well, that's kind of shutting down the trading in the stocks that were shooting higher and higher and higher. I cannot share with you the collective eye rolls that were coming from social media as they were reading through that thread. Yeah. But I know you can imagine them. By the time we got to Friday, a lot of people were musing about capitalism, how it only really works for rich people. And the minute
I've seen a lot of that too.
The minute that citizens say, hey, we worked out how to do it too, this is Ash's conclusion to what happened. Robin Hood decided to put a stop to their stock trading because regular people were making too much money, proving once again that any time the poor find a way to get any sort of financial foothold in this world, the billionaire class will move swiftly to crush them. That is one of thousands of very similar social posts about what happened this week.
Okay, another story gaining a lot of traction is about this prominent far-right Twitter user, Douglas McKay, who also went by the name Ricky Vaughn on Twitter. He was arrested Wednesday in West Palm Beach, Florida, and charged with using social media to spread misinformation aimed at black voters during the 2016 presidential election. A lot of chatter about this, Femi. What are you seeing?
Definitely. So Douglas Mackey, or Ricky Vaughn, as he was known on social, is a social media influencer. This charge from the Department of Justice, originally it goes back to actions that he did on the during the 2016 elections. And so the prosecution case is that what he did, what he tried to do with other co-conspirators was vote theft. And people were piling in, looking at this story, saying, well, this was 2016 elections. This was a bit late. Commenting on the timing, why now? And let me give you an example of what Ricky Vaughn did as a social media influencer. He posted a meme, a picture with a woman wanting to vote, and says, avoid the line, text this number. You can text your vote, you can put your vote on social media. Of course, that is not the case. So you're thinking, well, who would even fall for this kind of scam? More than 4,000 people used that number and tried to vote using that number. And you may be thinking, well, why is this important? This is back in 2016. Well, because social media platforms just last year were trying to tackle misinformation online. So if the Department of Justice are taking people to court for vote theft, for misinformation, that may well change what happens for future elections, Tonya.
Oh, interesting. We'll definitely be watching that. Before I let you go, I just have 30 seconds. The hashtag just as I am honoring Cicely Tyson. What are some of the social media posts that are moving you the most about this?
Oh, my goodness. There were so many and a lot of people were piling in. Shonda Rhimes, Kerry Washington, and people just remembering that what Cicely Tyson did was to use her career as a platform and as inspiration for many other people around the world. And if you look up Cicely Tyson online, you would definitely feel mission accomplished.
Femi Oke, thank you. Back in 2019, before Republican Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene was elected to office, a video was recorded showing her walking up to Parkland shooting survivor David Hogg and peppering him with questions. The video has now gone viral. Let's listen.
If Scott Peterson, the resource officer at Parkland, had done his job, then Nicholas Cruz wouldn't have killed anybody in your high school, or at least protected them. Why are you supporting red flag gun laws that attack our Second Amendment rights? And why are you using kids to get to, as a barrier? Do you not know how to defend your stance?
And what you heard there is David Hogg walking away. He didn't answer Marjorie Taylor Greene's questions. But the newly elected congresswoman is a known QAnon supporter. And Speaker Nancy Pelosi has slammed House Republicans for ignoring Greene's support for executing Pelosi and other prominent Democratic politicians. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has said he will speak with her, but most House Republicans have been quiet about it. Taylor Greene is now on the House Committee on Education and Labor. Let's bring in WABE reporter Lisa Hagan, who's been following the political rise of Representative Greene and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Tanya.
Okay, so before this week, a lot of Americans were not familiar with Greene. Who is she and what is her ideology?
So she started on social media around February 2017, according to the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, who you know, they track hate groups, and they started noticing her around then. She was trying to impeach. She was pushing a petition to impeach House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She accused Ilhan Omar of marrying her brother so that he could gain U.S. citizenship. And then she started attending a fair number of pro-Trump and right-wing rallies and really started linking up with some of the actors in those circles. And that was all before she that real breakthrough video that you played a clip of.
I want to interject here that one of the ideas she also supports, in addition to all of those you laid out, is that the deadly 2018 California fires were started by a Jewish laser beam from space. Of course, this is a false conspiracy theory rooted in anti-Semitism. I mean, how much of these ideas did she actually share on the campaign trail?
You know, that's not even one that I had heard of, Tanya. So it's not surprising to me that she would pick up on that. That's sort of the culture that really got her to the place that she is now. But once she started really campaigning, she turned down a bit of the conspiracy theory stuff. And what she did run on quite a bit, rather than, you know, those conspiracy theories, she was very anti-Antifa. And I would say that gun rights have been a really winning issue for her from the very beginning.
So tell us a little bit more about the area she represents. Who are her constituents? And is this what got her elected?
She represents an area up in northwest Georgia that certainly, you know, if you drive around there today, there's still plenty of, you know, pro-Trump signs out. You can see the occasional Confederate flag. It is a rural Georgia area with a lot of very, you know, conservative and far-right views.
Putting all of this into context, I mean, Georgia made headlines for electing two Democratic senators. But Marjorie Taylor Greene was also elected to the House. Is she an outlier there?
I think the two sort of go together. And I say that because she has been very, very closely allied with gun rights activists in the state. And in those circles, you hear a constant drumbeat of Georgia is changing. They're going to come for your guns soon enough. The state that you live in and grew up in and love is no longer, it's going to be unrecognizable soon. And I think someone like Marjorie Greene gaining popularity in a moment like this makes sense because this is the sort of inevitable backlash against the changes that we are seeing in the state politically.
Is Representative Greene, who has Trump supported, a sign of the former president's hold on the GOP, you think? Or does she represent another political trend? You said that, of course, we see that a small group can actually have a big impact, but perhaps one in which we see more candidates who propagate conspiracy theories.
You know, I think it is a little bit of both. I think certainly there are a lot of tactics that you can see Marjorie Greene using that are, you know, that are reminiscent of the president. But I also think that it is representative of a different trend that is forming. And I would call it more like a Tea Party 2.0. And I think the difference, you know, with someone like Marjorie Greene and someone like Donald Trump is that Trump is sort of known for being more of a chaotic political figure, right? Marjorie Greene, I think, you know, for Democrats probably represents a much more canny actor because she has very distinct views about what she wants and is very much a conservative, and I think is being advised by conservative actors who really have specific goals in mind.
Representative Greene, as you have noted, has a really strong online presence. And it's largely driven because she's sharing these types of ideas or videos that really support violence. I mean, that is what is of major concern for Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats and really the general public. I mean, what are your perceptions of this?
I think anyone who is concerned about the language that they're seeing out of Greene should understand that she is part of a community where that kind of language is exceedingly common. And I think we have seen that just in, you know, there were images of people building some sort of execution device at the January 6th riots in D.C. This is a common way that people in her circles speak about how to address political issues.
What are you keeping an eye on as Representative Greene continues her tenure in the House?
So some reporting has come out just today on how she's been spending her money. And that to me is a very interesting thing. She spent more than $200,000 on Parler, which is the now defunct alternative social media site that has been very popular amongst the far right. And she's been advertising there and on Telegram and all across these alternative messaging sites. I think we're going to see that Greene, like many of the gun rights activists that I've been studying in the state who she's linked up with, are very, very good at raising money. Where the money is coming from and where it's going is going to be where I'm keeping an eye on in the future.
That's WABE reporter Lisa Hagen. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
This year's popular Sundance Film Festival has gone virtual for the first time because of the pandemic. It began streaming the first of 71 films from around the world yesterday. And tomorrow, a new documentary premieres about the nationally ranked Lowell High School in San Francisco. It comes at a time when the school is reeling from the latest in a string of racist incidents. KQED's Chloe Veltman has more on the film called Try Harder.
Try Harder begins by underscoring popular beliefs about Lowell High School. It's highly competitive.
Lowell is the ultimate self-confidence crusher.
The students are excellent at multitasking.
I'm the captain of the tennis team. I'm also co-president of Lowell Build On, vice president of...
And the majority are Asian American.
My friend, he said, you go to an Asian excellency school.
But San Francisco director Debbie Lum is interested in digging beneath the stereotypes with her documentary, especially when it comes to race.
My film explores what it means to be stuck in boxes, especially along the lines of racial identity and how that impacts the college application process.
Even if you are a student who should be accepted at a school like this, you may not get in anyway.
In the movie, teacher Scott Dickerman tries to encourage students to look beyond the Ivy League because of allegations against some elite schools like Harvard of discriminating against Asian American applicants.
And that, in many cases, has to do with a little thing called ethnicity.
More than 50% of Lowell students identify as Asian American. That's almost double the average for San Francisco public schools. Meanwhile, less than 2% are black, which comes with its own set of challenges. In one scene, student Rachel Schmidt talks about the time she got a bad grade. She told her classmates her mum would be upset.
The girl across the table, she asked me, well, what ethnicity is your mom? And I was like, she's African American. And she said, that's so weird because I didn't expect for black people to actually care about their grades.
Debbie Lam says she observed microaggressions like this regularly at Lowell while shooting her film and began not long after nearly 30 students staged a walkout in protest against racism at the school in 2016. So she wasn't surprised to hear the news about the posting of anti-black and anti-Semitic slurs on a school-sponsored messaging platform last week.
It is a problem at Lowell.
But Lowell is by no means the only local public school grappling with racism, says San Francisco Board of Education President Gabriela Lopez.
Whether it be in our virtual space, whether it be in our physical classrooms, this is not the first time, unfortunately, that it's happened.
Justine Orgel is a current senior at Lowell and part of a group of students that publicly condemned last week's racist attacks. She says the school's exclusive admissions policy based on test scores is at least partly to blame.
We have this lack of representation of black students, Hispanic students.
Orgel says she wants to see the new documentary Try Harder. She hopes the film will give audiences the chance to see what the students at Lowell High School are really up against. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman in San Francisco.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
General Motors' latest announcement is sure to have a major impact on the automotive industry at large. The Big Three automaker says it will eliminate light-duty gas-powered vehicles by 2035 with an aim to be carbon neutral by 2040. This follows President Biden's executive order to replace the government's vehicle fleet with electric cars made in the U.S. Let's bring in Jamie LaRoe, a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, who covers GM and the auto industry. Welcome, Jamie.
Glad to be here.
Yes, so this is an ambitious goal. Tell us more about GM's plans to reach this goal of being carbon neutral by 2040.
It is an ambitious goal, and it requires a lot of players to make it happen. GM has been working on it for many years, and they have their Ultium battery system that will underpin their planned fleet of electric vehicles. But beyond that, there has to be an infrastructure in place. They've got to work with governments. They've got to work with suppliers. They've got to get a power grid that isn't just relying on electricity. It can be renewable energy, such as solar and wind. So there's a lot of moving parts here for GM to make this successful beyond just building the products and getting those products to market by 2035, which is why they've been careful to say they aspire to have that be the case.
Yes. A lot of moving parts also for Detroit. I mean, it's still very much a motor city that employs hundreds of thousands of people who work in the auto industry. How are industry workers and unions reacting?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should ask that because earlier today, someone sent me a study that basically said right now, Michigan in general, is the least prepared and friendly to have the infrastructure for electric vehicles. And that's exactly where General Motors is located, of course, their headquarters. So, you know, there's work to be done on that end. However, in terms of jobs, the union has been supportive and been in continual conversations with General Motors about this plan and the shift to EVs, and has an understanding and put out a statement yesterday that any jobs that come out of this will be union wage, union protected jobs. So there is that support on that end, and the automaker has assured that there won't be any job eliminations from it.
You know, this all lines up with Biden's recent executive orders on climate change, but this isn't just sustainability for GM. It's also smart business-wise, right?
Definitely. The global economy and other parts of the world, particularly China, where GM has a very large presence, already have electric vehicle mandates in place that GM has to work towards to meet and launch vehicles in those markets. So it makes sense to have your broad portfolio and an underlying propulsion system that is consistent for all the for all countries. And so, yes, it's definitely the direction the world is going. No matter who's in office, I think it's fair to say going forward, regulations are going to just continue to get stricter.
That's Detroit Free Press reporter Jamie LaRoe. Thank you so much, Jamie.
You're welcome.
In his first full week in office, President Biden has made clear that he wants to be transparent with the American public and the press corps. His new press secretary, Jen Psaki, vowed to hold daily press briefings, and the White House COVID-19 response team is already doing frequent updates. It is a contrast to the 4 years of former President Trump's twisting of the truth that often came along with targeted disrespect toward women and correspondents of color. Weijia Zhang has been on the receiving end of that. She's senior White House correspondent for CBS News. She's covered some of the biggest stories of Trump's presidency, from his election to his impeachments. Weijia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. And before we get to Donald Trump, I want to ask you what it's been like so far with this new administration. Have you noticed a change in the White House briefing room?
The change is almost jarring because of the relationship between the press office and reporters. And I think that it's just that there's an understanding now that we are in some ways working together to get the public the best information that we can, especially during a deadly pandemic. Now, that's not to say that, you know, we're friends and that we are somehow celebrating anything. But, you know, there is civility restored and a mutual respect. And I think that helps everybody do their jobs better.
No doubt a shift from the Trump administration. There were several occasions when President Trump was rude to you, dismissive of you for simply asking a question. In 2018, he called you obnoxious and told you to be quiet when you asked about North Korea. And then in the Rose Garden last May, this made headlines. You asked him how he could say the U.S. is outdoing other countries in coronavirus testing at a time when Americans were dying at just incredible rates. Here's how the president responded.
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer. Yes, behind you, please.
Sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you, I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
like
that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Why does it matter?
Okay.
Look, I know you never want to make yourself the center of a story, but how did you feel in that moment? What was going through your mind?
Well, every time we ask questions of anybody, when they try to take a hard shift, it's our job to understand the context around why. And my question didn't have anything to do with China in particular. It was more to try to understand his mindset around testing. And because he started asking me about China, I wanted to understand why and thought people deserve to know that context. Now, if he had talked about it, framing it in a way that explained why the global competition between the U.S. and China is important, and what that means as we, you know, try to meet American supply when there's demand everywhere, et cetera. It would have been different, but he didn't. And so I just wanted to know a simple question, which is why he was asking me that, because he didn't seem to bring up China out of nowhere to other reporters whose questions did not have to do with China.
Well, in the context is, in case it's lost on anybody, you were born in China and you came to the United States as a two-year-old child. Your colleague in the press corps, CNN White House correspondent Abby Phillip, once said that President Trump makes assumptions about reporters based on their ethnicity, and that's a pattern. Do you think that's true?
It's hard to say whether it's based on ethnicity, because President Trump does not discriminate when it comes to reporters that he tangles with and has conflict with. But being a woman of color covering President Trump offered a unforeseen challenge because of the way he spoke to women, and particularly women of color.
I want to play another piece of tape. This is from the moment in the White House Rose Garden again last May. After Trump ignores your follow-up question, he moves on to CNN's Caitlin Collins. Let's listen.
Okay. Anybody else? Please, go ahead in the back, please.
I have two questions.
No, it's okay.
But
we'll
you pointed to me. I have two questions, Mr.
Next.
President.
Next, please.
But you called on me.
I did, and you didn't respond, and now I'm calling on
the young lady
in the back, please.
I just wanted to let my colleague finish,
okay.
But can I ask you
ladies
a question,
and gentlemen,
please?
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
To your point about being a woman reporting on the Trump White House, to me it sounded like Caitlin Collins was trying to get him to answer your question before he moved on. Did you get a sense of camaraderie among the other women in the White House press corps, or was something like that, for example, just an example of two journalists backing each other up?
I think what people at home don't get to see is the camaraderie that we have with all of our colleagues in the White House press corps, because especially when the pandemic hit, we see each other often more times than we see our own family members and friends. And it is a pretty basic protocol to allow a colleague to finish their line of questioning. In that case, you know, Caitlin heard me trying to repeat my follow-up question. And in doing so, as we just heard, lost her own opportunity to ask him a question because he clearly retaliated against her. He did not appreciate the fact that she allowed me to ask a second question, and that's why he moved on from her. In his own words, that's why he did. And so it was actually Yamiche Alcindor, who the president has disparaged many times. He was trying to call on in place of Caitlin, and Yamiche was doing the exact same thing that Caitlin had just done for me. Mm. So that was a really memorable moment for me because there were three of us who, you know, I think just had a mutual respect of each other. And in the end, that forced the president to abruptly turn and leave.
So what have the last 4 years taught you? I mean, has covering Donald Trump changed you in any way as a journalist or as a person?
You know, I've reflected a lot about the past 4 years, and I think covering Donald Trump is a once-in-a-lifetime assignment because Donald Trump is a once-in-a-lifetime president. I'm certainly trained now to handle a heavy amount of news at any given time. And, you know, the pace at which we were used to covering President Trump has, you know, already changed. And so I think that when the news cycle changes, you know, within hour by hour rather than sometimes day by day or week by week in what's, you know, a more normal administration.
I can relate to that, no doubt about it. So how do you think the press corps is going to handle the new president? Because there's always going to be tension between journalists and the president if we're doing our jobs right. But I have a feeling, for better or worse, it's not going to be the same tense place as it was under Donald Trump.
That's right. And that's because I think President Biden would like to engage with the press more than he does. But, you know, he has an entire communications team that has carefully mapped out his engagements, and he listens to that. That's the difference between, I think, President Trump and anyone else who will be in the Oval Office. Everything we've seen so far has been very measured, and you hear White House officials saying the same things, which is something we didn't see under Trump because there were different factions competing against each other, contradicting each other. And I think, you know, that lended itself to more questions from us because we had to clear up misstatements so often. So I think with President Biden, of course, there has to be tension and there has to be holding him and everyone around him to account during a really historic and critical time for Americans. So I certainly expect there will be confrontations, but I doubt it will be personal.
Weijia Zhang, senior White House correspondent for CBS News, thank you so much for the work you do. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Back before the pandemic, TV host Wendy Williams would pack her studio with adoring fans.
Now, here's Wendy.
Now the gossip mogul is getting buzz for producing a new film entirely about herself. Wendy Williams, the movie, premieres tomorrow on Lifetime, and it's the latest example of a celebrity teaming up with filmmakers to tell their own story. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. And Eric, Wendy Williams, love her or hate her, she is extremely popular. This latest project, though, is not a documentary at all. It's a dramatized movie. How does it portray her?
Well, first I have to ask, how you doing?
How you doing? I think I say it better.
Yeah, I think you say it much better. This is, of course, a scripted dramatic movie about her rise to prominence. And even people who know her famous TV talk show might not realize that she started out as a DJ who began to sort of spice up her radio broadcasts by talking about gossip inside the music industry. You know, she started out in sort of black-focused radio stations, and so she was talking about the kind of gossip that even Page Six, you know, in the New York Post and places like that weren't talking about. And I think that sort of led to her prominence. Later, she became kind of known for her own personal dysfunctions, and she's been open about her struggle with substance abuse, for example. But, you know, like a lot of these shows, the most interesting parts are when the people are kind of building their celebrity. Mm-hmm. And we've got a great scene where we see a little bit of her getting ready to go on stage for her TV show. And then she turns and she talks to the camera to sort of explain what people are going to see in this biopic. Let's listen to that clip.
I mean, everybody's been asking me behind the scenes, behind the hype. I mean, Wendy, how you really doing? I've had a lot of time to think about it. And I've had enough with everybody else telling me who I really am. So now, it's time to dish my own dirt.
Okay.
So there you go.
Well, Eric, you mentioned her personal dysfunction. Her brand is very much tell it like it is. But we do know, as you said, she's been in the gossip media for so long about her personal life and drama. Can we expect this movie to really be a reliable source since she's so intimately involved?
Well, you know, I say her personal brand is personal dysfunction. Mm. There have been times when you watch her on her show and she seemed out of it or she's acted erratically. And I think in an odd way, people are showing up just to see if the car actually crashes sometimes. But she is honest about some really tough stuff. She depicts an allegation that she made that a one-hit wonder R&B star date raped her when she was up and coming. She also depicts how her longtime husband cheated on her often. And towards the end of the movie, she goes into rehab, but she also discovers that her husband is about to have a baby with one of his mistresses while she's in rehab. And she realizes that the bad press is really taking a toll on her show. And so we have a scene where she's on the phone talking about all of this. Let's check it out.
Yeah, it's me. How did I get a phone? Because I'm smarter than you. Now, I know that I agreed to stay here in Florida for a hot minute, but a few things have come to my attention, and it is no longer tenable.
Number one, our show is falling apart because of all the bad press about me. I mean, sponsors are dropping out. Do you want that? I mean, this is our livelihood. We could lose everything. Yeah, so get me the hell out of here and book me a plane ticket back to New York. Because I gotta save my show.
Yeah, so, you know, this film promises to give you even more of a backstage look at some of the key problems and conflicts that shaped her legend.
Well, Eric, there's also another movie that's similar. It's the biopic about rap duo Salt-N-Pepa on Lifetime. And the group had a lot of creative say in this piece. And then there's this Michael Jordan doc that was really popular, The Last Dance, with ESPN, Kevin Hart's Netflix docuseries about himself. Those, of course, are documentaries. But is this a proven model? Do you think we'll see a lot more of these kinds of projects?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so that Salt-N-Pepa biopic aired earlier, and they took flack because they didn't really talk a lot about Spinderella, who is the third member of the act. And wow. You know, famously, they have been on the outs. Spinderella claimed that she was fired from the group in 2019. And so you might understand why they might minimize her role in the TV film, but still, you wonder. And what's interesting is I think we're entering a moment where celebrities realize people want the sense that they're seeing an authentic story. So they can't really hold back all the negative stuff. But I do think that their very presence can influence the filmmakers to pull their punches a little bit.
Right, right.
So this is a new form of storytelling that we have to keep an eye on, because it's easy to assume that these shows are telling you most of what happened, but you have no idea what they're leaving out. And I think that's the one thing that is a flaw when you have the star themselves on board as an executive producer.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking about Wendy Williams, the movie. It comes out tomorrow on Lifetime. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.